The date is April 17, 2009, and we are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. We are interviewing Larry Edward Kaysen, and the following interview is being conducted as a part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Larry was born on July 1, 1946 in Fernandina Beach, Florida. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Donald Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Larry, what was your period of service?
From June 15, 1964 until June 30, 1990.
Okay. And during what conflicts did you serve?
Vietnam era.
The Vietnam era. Thank you. And what was your highest rank achieved?
Master Chief Petty Officer.
Okay. Where did you serve?
Various duty stations within the United States in Pacific and two ships in the Atlantic.
Okay. Thank you. Larry, how did you first become involved in military service? Can you give us some idea of that?
When I graduated from high school in 1964, here in Fernandina, there wasn't a lot of opportunities. Both the mills had nepotism rules, and my dad was at one, my uncle was at the other, so that ruled that out. Not that I particularly wanted to work at the mill, but college wasn't really an option, and that pretty much left the military. And I had an uncle who was a chief in the Navy then, and he sort of pushed me in the right direction, and within 2 weeks of graduation, I was pretty much on my way.
So you enlisted here in Fernandina?
Yes. Well, Jacksonville, but I had my first face-to-face with the recruiter at the post office downtown.
Oh, okay. And then when did you enter basic training?
June 15th. I left Fernandina or Jacksonville on June 15th and arrived at Great Lakes the morning of the 16th of June, 64.
Okay.
And spent 8 weeks in recruit training and graduated back here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your basic?
It was a completely different experience. we arrived in Chicago at about 1 o'clock in the morning, I think, and the bus driver finally picked us up at O'Hare and took us out to her training center. And it was probably about 4 in the morning when we got there. And of course, all of us had been up all night. And instead of saying, okay, boys, go lay down and take a nap, you know, get some rest, right into training. And it didn't change much from there on. It was a whole different way of life, really. And you learned immediately that you did as you were told and when you were told. And so you got the structure. And they got all the civilian out of you and put all the new military into you. So, but it was, in retrospect, it wasn't that bad. At the time, it was hell.
So then you graduated from basic, and when was that?
August of 64.
And what was your first duty assignment then?
I went to school in Pensacola to become what then was called a communications technician. When I enlisted in the electronics field, and I was 17 years old and not very worldly, and they said, okay, you're going to be a communications technician. They couldn't tell me a lot about it. They just said it was a classified job. And I was led to believe I was going to be working in repair. And I got to Pensacola and I found out I was going to be what they called a collection operator, that I was going to have to learn Morse code and copy Morse code, which didn't appeal to me, but by then they had convinced me that you do what they say and when they say it. So I completed the school, and it turned out another one of those decisions that was sound, because I enjoyed what I did.
in a collection operator, you're what, collecting messages? You're collecting intelligence?
You're copying foreign communications.
Oh, okay.
And then from there you go into different branches. You know, my specialty was pretty much direction finding. But everything is collected and bearings are obtained on them, and it's all put together somewhere else.
So when were you first able to put this newfound knowledge to use?
I graduated from school in Pensacola in about the end of March of 65 or the beginning of April. And I had orders to Adak, Alaska, which is about 1,200 miles into the Aleutians from Anchorage. And I wasn't real pleased with that, but again, you do what they say. And I got out there, and I can say that I learned more probably in 8 hours there than I learned in 5 or 6 months of school in Pensacola. It was a different experience, and professionally. And was a year there working direction finding and, you know, in a real world environment. And you got a great deal of personal satisfaction, or I did, of what I was doing. We're providing bearings on different Chinese, Soviet, anything that really transmitted was a target of opportunity.
So how did you keep from freezing to death up there?
Well, several different ways. Most everything was inside. The barracks, the chow hall, the library, the gym, the movie theater was all in one interconnected building.
I see.
And you would catch a bus right outside the chow hall, and the bus would take you to work, and you're off the bus, and in 10 steps you're in the operations building. So you didn't have to go outside all that much. Although the weather during the summer months, although not pleasant by Florida standards, wasn't that bad. It would maybe get up in the 40s, and you just bundle up and go outside and hike through the tundra.
Did they keep that outpost pretty well supplied with, you know, food and necessities?
Oh, absolutely. There was a supply ship, I guess. I forget what they called it, but it was a supply ship that came in weekly from the States. And we were on a different part of the island, the communication station, than the naval station. It's two different entities. We're about 9 miles apart. And the supply ship would come in at the naval station, and that's where all of our provisions and necessities came from. Plus, they had military flights that came in from time to time that would bring things in.
Okay, and so then you spent a year?
1 year, 1 week, and 1 day.
Okay, and then where did they send you from that point?
From there, I went to Sabana Seca, Puerto Rico, to the Naval Security Group, where they called it a Naval Radio Station. And, but en route there, I had to go, my orders read that I had to go from Adak to, after my leave, that I was to report to Charleston for transportation to Puerto Rico. And there is a world of difference between being a CT in the Navy and being a fleet sailor in the Navy, especially in 1966. And I got to Charleston, and I was a third-class petty officer then. I'd been promoted, and I was treated like royalty. You know, the guy said, you're in charge of this, you're in charge of that. You don't have to do any work. You know, you've got these seamen to do it for you. And I said, you know, this Navy's pretty good. So I spent about a week there, and I was beginning to like that pretty well. But then I went on down to Puerto Rico, and being raised in Fernandina in the 50s and 60s was a far cry from being in Puerto Rico in the 60s. And I sort of fell in love with the place. It was just a completely new experience to me. And I spent, I got there in June of 66, and liked it so well. I made E5 in October of 66, and liked it so well, I decided I would re-enlist. They dangled a lot of money at me at the time, or what seemed like a lot at the time, and I guess it was. They had a very variable reenlistment program, and so I received about $8,000, $9,000 to reenlist, and there started my career.
Well, can you give us some idea of what it was about Puerto Rico that you liked, you know, and what was different about that in living in Fernandina?
Well, it was a lot of girls there. and it was the first time in my life I'd ever been able to drink legally. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're 20 years old, it was a pretty big deal. And you just go down to San Juan at night. I mean, we would get off our shift at say 10:30 at night, and of course the nightlight didn't really pick up there until like midnight. And you just go downtown and have a great time until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, go back and go to bed. And so that worked out okay for about a year or so. And then after I re-enlisted, they gave me early orders. Instead of having a 2-year tour there, I was transferred early. And I went up to Cheltenham, Maryland, which is just outside Washington, D.C.
Where was that in Maryland?
Cheltenham.
Cheltenham, oh, okay.
And that was the net control for our Atlantic direction finding network. They did all the final analysis, so to speak. And I spent, I think, only 10 months there because they closed that mission there and moved it down to Chesapeake, Virginia. So
did you move with them to Chesapeake?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but during the time that I was there, I met a young lady from West Virginia, and we got married, and over the course of the years, had 3 kids. Anyway, she came down to Chesapeake with me, and I spent 2 years down there. And it was interesting, the chief that I worked for in Cheltenham was part of the move also. And I got down to Chesapeake, and I worked for him there. Same guy. It was almost like, well, you go to work one day and you come back the next, and same chief, different location. Mm-hmm. And I spent 2 years there, and my first son was born there. And I made first class while I was there, E6. And after my 2-year tour there, I got orders to Guam, which that was in November of 70 that I reported there. I had another school in the interim, en route to Guam, which lasted about 6 weeks. So it was back to Pensacola for 6 weeks, which was sort of nondescript because the guy who wrote the curriculum for the school came to Chesapeake to get all the information from us for the school. So it was sort of like a vacation, really. And but by that time, my wife was pregnant with our second child, was a daughter, and so she couldn't travel concurrently with me to Guam, so she stayed here in Fernandina, and I went to Guam, and lo and behold, I got to work for the same chief, because he transferred to Guam also. So that was pretty unique. My second child was born while I was in Guam, not long after I got there. She was born here in Fernandina on January 1st of 71. And then after about 6 weeks, family came over and joined me there.
And so what was your total time in Guam?
Just a little bit over 2 years, a few days over 2 years. I tried unsuccessfully about three times to extend, and the Bureau of Naval Personnel said no way that I had to go. So,
but what kind of duties did you perform over in Guam while you were stationed there?
I worked primarily direction finding until the last probably 8 months. I was involved in athletics a lot, specifically softball. And the division officer asked me if I would coach the division softball team. And so I was coaching the division softball team. And then the director of special services asked me about coaching the station softball team. And back during that time, sports in the Navy was a big thing. Sports in the military was a big thing. And this was fast pitch softball. And I was young, but I felt confident. So I agreed to do that. And it got to the point where my athletics were taking away from my my professional job. So they said, well, you're just going to be a full-time coach. So I coached two softball teams for about the last 8 months I was there. The station team went on to win the island championship, and then we went from, as a team, we went from Guam up to Japan for the Western Pacific championship, and we won there and went on to Long Beach, California to the All-Navy championship, where we were dispatched early. But it was a great experience, and the command was very good to me. The security group was very good to me, because they didn't hold it against me the fact that I was working out of rate, or I was doing things out of rate. Mm-hmm. So, and shortly after the end of the season, I transferred to Misawa, Japan, up in northern Honshu.
And what were your duties there?
Direction finding.
Direction finding again.
Again. But this, the pattern is that you go from, one duty station to another, and if you start putting these together, you see the strategic locations of them for cross bearings for the direction finding. But I spent about 32 months there. And another enjoyable, it was a large command for our job, for cryptology. And whereas I had been able to make a name for myself, I guess, at other places, you get lost in the shuffle in Japan, but I still enjoyed it. It was a good tour for me. It was interesting because you're involved in a completely new environment. I had never lived in a foreign speaking country before, and you experience a whole different culture.
Did you live on base there?
Yes. When I initially got there, for about the first month, I lived off base in a genuine Japanese house. And that was a big difference. But I lived on base for the rest of the time.
Can you give us some idea of what kind of equipment that you used for direction finding back then?
I could tell you, but it probably wouldn't make that much difference. It was a circularly disposed antenna array called a Woolenweber, which probably covers maybe 10 to 15 acres, and that's the antenna field itself. And in the middle of this big, giant elephant cage, if you will, is your operations building, which is probably about twice as big as this building here. the museum building. Depending on the mission of the sites, a lot of sites are dual mission in that they do a collection, they do direction finding, they do analysis, just a lot of different things. So obviously, you know, the more missions you have, the bigger the operations building has to be.
Did you perform in shifts?
Yes. They had different variations of it, but it seemed like the most popular within all my my duties was what we call a 2-2-2 and 80, where you work 8 on, 16 off, 8 on, 8 off, 8 on, 16 off, and you work 2 days, 2 mids, which were your midnight to 8 shift, and then 2 eves, which was your 4 to 12, and then you get 80 hours off. So you're working 48 hours to get about, 80 off, to 3.5 days. And it gave you a lot of time off to, especially if you're in a foreign country, to travel and see things and to rest up. The double bats, as we call them. You get off at 4 in the afternoon and have to go back at midnight that night. That would take its toll from time to time, but it still afforded you a lot of opportunities because of the amount of time you got off.
Mm-hmm. And so then when did you leave Japan?
I left Japan in July of 75 and went to Homestead, Florida. Let me back up a little bit. And when I was in Japan, I was on an Air Force base. And we were just they were the parent command, we were the tenant command. And then I went to Homestead Air Force Base. We had a naval security group activity in Homestead with a separate operations building. And we were, again, a tenant command to the Air Force. And life on an Air Force Base is pretty good. They treat their people well. They have a lot of really first-rate facilities, whereas the other services, in my opinion, tend to put operations a little bit ahead of morale, I guess. But I was there for 2 years or about 18 months, and the commanding officer and my division officer called me in and told me there was a fantastic opportunity for me to rise to the top, so to speak, and do some of the things that you needed to do for promotion. And one of those things was to volunteer for a shipboard assignment. Up to that point, I'd been in about 12 years and had never been aboard ship, which wasn't unusual for the security group personnel. Although we did have a few ships that were dedicated to that. So they encouraged me, and I took the plunge and volunteered and spent almost a year aboard a guided missile cruiser, which was in a research and development program to have shipboard direction finding. And I went on a med cruise. I had to go through a factory training up in the D.C. area through Sperry Systems. And I went through that. And then we made a med cruise, which I thought was fantastic. I'd heard all these things about fleet sailors. I know the first night aboard ship, I got there in the afternoon, and they said, "Well, we don't have any place for you, but this guy's on leave, so you can sleep in his bunk." And they're stacked three high. And that was kind of a different thing. So I said, "Well, you know, okay." So I got some clean linen and made the bed up. And about 4:30 in the morning, I hear this horrendous voice Reveille, Reveille, Reveille. And I thought, what is that? I'm an E6 in the Navy and been in for 12 years, and I'd never heard that since A school in Pensacola in 64. And then he said something that was totally foreign to me. He said something about heave out and trice up. I was clueless. And that's just terms they use, you know, heave out, get out of the rack and trice up. The bottom bunk was on hinges, and you trice that bunk, you lifted it up and put a prop underneath it so the sweepers could sweep out from beneath the bunk and clean there. And so I had my first lesson in nautical language, I guess, that morning. And we got underway and went down to Yorktown to the weapons station, or up to Yorktown, I guess, to the weapons station to unload ordnance. Well, I didn't know anything about that, so I stayed in my bunk. When we got there, and they said, "Oh, you've got to come up and do this other stuff." I said, "Huh?" And it was fun. It was an experience, and of course, we go on liberty that afternoon, and I'm thinking, well, you know, we'll come in when we get ready to. No, we have to be in by 1 o'clock. I said, wow, what am I, some kid?
Different.
But you know, I adjusted, and I guess probably about 6 weeks later, we made way for the Mediterranean.
And what was the name of the ship?
Oh, the USS Josephus Daniels, guided missile cruiser.
Okay.
And nice. We were operating with another ship that was had been outfitted with the same equipment, USS Mitcher, which was an old destroyer. And we had to operate together. You know, there was no independent operations because, you know, you had to have two bearings to get across to, you know, to target. And the Mitcher spent a lot of time down because of its age, and it was just why they selected that particular ship, I don't know. But as a result, we spent a lot of time in port, and that wasn't a bad thing. I got a golden opportunity to visit a lot of places, the Mediterranean littoral countries that I'm sure a lot of people would, you know, we met people who paid to do it, you know, mm-hmm. and they were paying us. But we were going for about 9 months on the cruise itself, and came back, and then I was reassigned back to Homestead, and which is where I left my family. And true to form, as a captain and the division officer had told me, I made chief while I was there, and which was probably at least one of the top five things that happened to me in the Navy. And I guess probably a little less than a year after I got back, I transferred from there back to ADAC, Alaska again.
This is voluntarily?
No.
Okay.
No. That's the only place that I never asked for that I got. And so I went back. But it was a whole different learning process. And I might add that when I was there the first time, it was a great place to start in a career field, because I really learned a lot. And I would spend extra time at work just to have something to do. And I would go out, finally the chief in this other section, I would go out and help them. And he said, "Nah," he said, "you can't come out here anymore." He said, "These guys, you know, they have to learn too, the ones that were assigned to that duty section." So it was a great learning process. And when I went back, it was my first assignment as a chief petty officer. And I was a division chief of a DF division, direction finding division. And that was another learning experience, because I had probably 40 people in my division, and you're pretty much responsible for me. I went in a division officer. It was a lieutenant who was going all the time because he was saddled with collateral duties, primarily the physical security officer. And there were two chiefs below me, and his philosophy was, if I've got three chiefs, and if you can't handle this division, I'll fire you and get somebody who can. So it was trial and error for a while, and a few errors, but mostly things worked out well.
Did you have a lot of personnel problems you had to deal with?
Not a lot, a few. At that time, the females were pretty much standard in the security group. They hadn't been in the security group until the mid-70s is when they first came back into the security group. And there weren't a lot. You go to Homestead, we had a fair amount, but still, I got to ADAC, and we had quite a few female cryptologists there. And there was one young lady who was taken. She was a bit upset over the fact that I had to move her from one duty section to another, and she couldn't be in the same section as her boyfriend. And I told her that that wasn't the mission of the Navy. And she got really mad, and she had these big tears coming out of her eyes. And I had a CTA, and I can't remember his name. He was a young third class, and he was sitting there while I was talking to this girl. And she got mad, and she stormed out the door, which really upset me. So I followed her, and I got out in the passageway, and I yelled, "Come back here." And the A brancher looked at me, and he says, he was from Alabama, and he says, "Chief, you reckon if I cry real tears and blow snot bubbles, I can get my way?" I glared at him, and he was sorry. But she came back in, and I explained the situation to her and told her that she was bordering on insubordination, and that she needed to reassess her stance in this particular situation. So that was probably the most interesting, or probably the worst situation I had, because it was, I mean, she did that in front of several people, and you know, I couldn't let it go. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I earned the respect of a lot of people by handling it the way that I did. And that was quite a boost to my ego. So, and then after at a 15-month, actually it was supposed to be a 15-month tour, and I got there in September. It was supposed to be an 18-month tour. And I got there in September, I believe, of 78. And I was notified by the Bureau that I was going to be transferred early, and that I would be leaving in December, going to the USS John F. Kennedy out of Norfolk. And it just struck me as odd that I would be sent from one crappy duty station to another. I mean, generally that didn't happen. And I had been talking to the guy a month earlier, and he pretty much assured me that I could go to the Philippines or maybe Hawaii. But just out of the blue, you're going to the Kennedy. And I was pretty upset by that. And but as things happened throughout my naval career, it turned out to be a great thing. I went to the Kennedy, and it was just a super tour for me.
The reason initially you considered that not a welcomed assignment was because you'd be away from your family? Or?
Well, it was a variety of things. Number one, the family separation.
Yeah.
Number two, it was something totally new to me. Mm-hmm. Communication security was the primary mission of the SECRU division on the Kennedy. Communication security, meaning on force monitoring. You monitored the pilots. You monitored the ship's communications. And you did analysis on what you intercepted or collected and filed a report. And to let the air wing and the communications people know that, hey, you could be giving away bits of information that could be advantageous to a potential enemy. And I had never done that before. It was considered probably the dregs for being a CTR, which was a collection. That was the bottom of the barrel. And but as it turned out, it wasn't so. That was the primary means we were there, and it was just an interesting tour. I made a Mediterranean cruise, and it was a world of difference being on a ship as a chief, as opposed to being on a ship as a first class petty officer. It was a world of difference being on an aircraft carrier compared to being on a guided missile cruiser. You can't describe how much better it is. It rides, you know, it's like being in a Yugo and a Rolls Royce.
Mm-hmm.
The living conditions were still three bunks high, but in the chief's quarters, it was a little bit better. And the amount of responsibility that he had was tremendous. And I faced it head on and enjoyed it.
And how long were you on the Kennedy?
3 years. A little over 3 years, I guess. About 3 years and 2 months.
Was that before the Kennedy was stationed in Jacksonville?
Yeah.
Or before?
It was out of Norfolk at the time.
Uh-huh.
And we made, like I say, we made two cruises, and plus a lot of local area ops or Caribbean ops. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of interesting things. We were down in Guantanamo doing Caribbean ops. We were anchored in the harbor, and we stayed there for several hours. And as we got underway, a little Cuban auxiliary aircraft flew directly over the top of us, and that was something that was considered, it was a slap in the face. And any time you're in port or at sea, even if you're not considered in a flight ready posture, you always have the two F-14 CAPS combat air patrol aircraft that are ready to take off. They're on the flight deck, and apparently the pilots of the two CAPS were asleep or something, because they didn't get in the air for like 5 minutes after this had happened. Of course, you're right there in Cuba, so this airplane by then had gone back over Cuban landmass, and there was nothing we could do. But
was that considered to be just a mistake by that person or a provocation?
Oh, it was a provocation. Uh-huh. It was just letting us know that they could, and they knew that we wouldn't follow them into their airspace. And but they had been in the area all day, and we knew they were there. But it was something that the commanding officer of an aircraft carrier does not want to be overflown by a foreign aircraft. I mean, it's like you're in harm's way. That means if a guy can overfly you and not do anything, that means he could overfly you and do anything he wanted, really. And so some people probably heard about that, but fortunately for us, we had been advising the Combat Information Center throughout the day that this aircraft was in the area. So, but just things like that were totally foreign to me. They were interesting, and it was all part of the excitement.
So then, when you came back to the States, of course, you docked again in Norfolk.
Right.
And from that point, where were you sent?
I went back out to Chesapeake, Virginia.
Okay.
It was interesting because the detailer, the guy who issues your orders, I had been in touch with him, and matter of fact, I went up to D.C. and sat and talked to him, and he told me that I could go pretty much any place I wanted to go, and I said, well, it would be cheaper for the Navy and more convenient for me just to go from Norfolk out to Chesapeake. It was about 30 miles. And he said, well, he said, you know, I appreciate that. He said, because that frees me up to do some things with people that I will have to move further anyway. And it was a 3-year tour in Chesapeake, and I worked in what we call direct support, which is support to the fleet with cryptologic resources. You can't put, say, a 30-man contingent on board ship, or it wasn't reasonable to do that, and expect you get the best use out of them, because you're in port. You finish your cruise and you're back in Norfolk or wherever, and these guys, these are assets that are being wasted, really. So what they would do is they would assign a skeleton crew, so to speak, and then when you deployed, they would augment your crew with people from different areas. You may get a Russian linguist and a Spanish linguist from Fort Meade up in Maryland, and they would come down and ride with you if you were going down in the Caribbean. And when we would go to the Mediterranean, we would always have a Russian linguist that would ride. He would come out of Rota, Spain, and ride with us, and along with a Hebrew linguist and an Arab linguist. It just depended on your area of operations. If you were going down in the Indian Ocean, you would pick up several different dialects, Arab dialects, Farsi, Arab, I forget all the, so in Chesapeake, we provided the resources for these ships that were getting underway. So it was up to me to train, make sure these guys were trained and ready to go to sea. And I would assign them for periods of time, ranging from 2 weeks to up to a full cruise of 7, 8, 9 months. And that was another interesting assignment because I had about 30 young men, 18 to 21 years old, working for me. And as soon as I left the Kennedy, I'm ADA, I'm a senior chief. And that was probably one of the highlights, I guess, because all of a sudden it dawned on me, I've got these young guys and they're very impressionable, and I need to take care of them. I need to make them feel like they're contributing, because a lot of them were married and had their families there. And a young married guy doesn't want to leave a wife and a baby and go on a 6-month cruise. And so I really made an exerted effort to pick and choose and send the guys that didn't have so much to leave behind on the longer cruises. But what really came to mind was, you know, these guys can make me look like a superstar, or they can make me look like blah. And I think that if I take care of them, they'll take care of me, because, you know, you're only as good as the people who work for you. Mm-hmm. And it was like a light bulb went off. And I did. I made a concerted effort to really take care of these guys. And they did. They took care of me because I made Master Chief. And not there, but my next assignment. And it was a very enjoyable. You know, I felt a great sense of accomplishment because all these guys worked very hard for me. And and I had a good professional and military rapport with them.
Probably a really fine sense of satisfaction there with that work, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I did a lot of traveling while I was there. I left that particular job within the command. They moved me over to another training job, and I was in charge of the training for reservists and worked in conjunction with an ex-A branch chief that I had known in the past. He was a limited duty officer, a lieutenant down in Charleston, who was in charge of all the reserves east of Mississippi. And these are cryptologic reservists. So I went to a lot of reserve centers to do training. And that was interesting because I had a pretty questionable opinion of reservists up to that time. But after visiting several of these reserve centers, I learned that the majority of these guys are really dedicated individuals. And you know, they want to do a good job. They enjoy what they do. And it was all strictly voluntary. You know, they gave up quite a bit. But it was... It was interesting. I remember I was in Cincinnati, and their rule there, and you had more than just the cryptologic reservists. All the reserves there, you might have some CVs or some engineering types, but you would have your one little cryptologic group here. But they all worked within the same building. So they had one commanding officer who was in charge of the entire unit, and then each different entity, like the SET group, would have a commanding officer. And we were coming back from lunch, and we had assigned these operators to do some collection, manual Morse collection, and I was going to do an analysis on it when I got back. So I didn't come back until about an hour after the reservist had come back from lunch. So I walk into the building, and they have a quarterdeck set up, and young sailor standing up there in his dress blues, and he stops me and checks my ID, and he told me I was going to have to make up that hour. I was an hour late, and I was going to have to make up that hour after 1600, the knockoff work time. I said, "What?" He was explaining to me the command policy was if you're late coming back for lunch, you made that up afterwards. Everybody put in 8 hours, and I thought, yeah, that's pretty impressive. I said, but I'm not attached here. And he looked at my ribbons and noticed that I had active duty Navy good conduct, and he says, "You're not a reservist, are you?" I said, "No." He says, "I'm sorry, sir." He took his job seriously, and I appreciated that.
That had to be a comforting feeling to realize how serious these reservists were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
That's good. And then where from there, Larry?
From there, I was on a downward spiral in a 15, 16-year marriage at the time, I guess. And the divorce was imminent. By then, back in Japan, we had another son, so we had two sons and a daughter. And I knew that my oldest son would be graduating from high school there in Chesapeake. So I was going to take an assignment to Iceland. I was going to ask for an assignment to Iceland because it was near Virginia as far as getting military transport back and forth. And the detailer told me that I should consider taking an assignment to Korea. And he explained all the pros and cons, and there were a lot of pros, and I can't think of any cons. But he said it was almost a guaranteed promotion. You got a guaranteed assignment afterwards, any place you wanted to go that had an opening. And that I could take mid-tour leave and come back to my son's graduation. But as it worked out, I got back in February before he graduated anyway.
All right.
Larry?
So I went to, I chose Korea, went over there. That was a good assignment for me. I was command senior chief over there, and it was another different culture, but I found out the Korean people loved Americans. I got my guaranteed following assignment, and I selected to go to the recruit training center in Orlando because it was relatively close to Fernandina, and I was unsure of what I was going to do. So I went there, and I had to train two companies before I went into my full-time job. I was a discipline officer. We had a lot of discipline problems down there, as can be understood. You got a lot of kids coming in recruit training. We had a lot of staff problems, too. After about a year and a half or so as a discipline officer, the commanding officer assigned me to what they call the AT, Advanced Training Division, where these young recruits would go after they graduated from school or recruit training. If they didn't have a school assignment, they went through advanced training. One particular young man that I remember, he had done something minor, and the division officer at the time had told him that he was going to have to write a 500-word essay about some meaningless subject. So the kid, halfway through his essay, he wrote down that he thought that was the dumbest thing he'd ever done. You know, he was a man in the Navy. He enlisted in the Navy to become a man, and he was being treated like a kid. And, of course, he used a little more salty language. And then he continued on in his essay. Well, this lieutenant had historically never read any of these essays, but decided to read this particular one. And so he read it and became very irate and wanted to castigate this kid, and so he was written up for disrespect or failure to obey a lawful order or something like that. And so the kid came to me and asked for help, and I talked to the captain, and I told him I agreed with the kid, I thought it was dumb. And so the captain said, okay, handle it any way you want to, and I assigned the young man some extra duty. Well, I went on and enjoyed the tour. I ended up remarrying while I was there, but I married a childhood sweetheart here in Fernandina who I had grown up with, and I was commuting back and forth. But anyway, after I'd retired, and I retired as a master chief in June of 1990, came back here, and I received a letter in the mail one day, and if I might read it, I had no idea who it was from, and I opened it and said, Dear Master Chief, it's been 1 year since you helped me get out of Division 10 and into ETA school, which is electronics training. You may remember me as the one who painted the rank rate insignia on the quarterdeck wall and painted apprenticeship training Division 10 over the doors. Well, even if you don't remember me, I remember you. 1 year ago, I appealed to you to have my mask dropped. Against all odds, it seemed, you had the case dropped and I was free. You might say that when I was lowest, you gave me a hand. You restored my faith in the Navy and in myself. Last Thursday, I graduated from ETA school and tacked on my third class group. Friday, I went to the VFW and bought a round of beer there. Occasionally, I meet someone who reminds me of you, 4-0. But it seems all too rare these days. Anyways, I just thought I would write and tell you I made it. Thanks for all your help, respectfully. And he signed his name. And that meant a lot to me because I saw a lot of good in this kid, young man. And he went on and was successful in the Navy, and he wanted to let me know he was. And it still makes me feel good. That was 20-something years ago.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
That is a great story.
To me, I couldn't have ended a career on any better terms than that.
Mm-hmm. To know that you actually significantly affected this guy's life you know, to make him have a better outlook in the Navy.
Absolutely.
And be successful. I think that is really wonderful. So, your duty station in Orlando, then that's where you retired from the Navy?
Yes. The hottest day in the history of man. They had a mock-up of a Navy ship there. And that's where most of the retirements, weather permitting, were held. And it was June about 28th of 90. And it was just unbelievably hot. Everybody was just soaked with sweat. Mm-hmm. But it was the happiest, probably the one of the happiest days of my life.
And a very memorable experience,
yes.
I'm sure.
26 years and 2 weeks.
Well, that's great. And then back to Fernandina, and you're now living in Fernandina again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure as a person who was born and grew up in Fernandina that you've seen a lot of development through the years.
Yes, absolutely. It was a big, big change. This building we're in right now, my dad was an auxiliary deputy sheriff, or a part-time deputy sheriff, actually, for Sheriff Youngblood. And I was up here. He brought me up here, I guess, in the 50s and kind of made an impression on me. I never wanted to come back up here as a guest.
Okay. Is there anything else, Larry, that you need to let us know about as far as your military service is concerned? Or?
No, I really can't think of anything. I'm sure there's probably a lot of things. This has been almost an hour, and it seemed like about 15 minutes. Yeah. And I truly enjoyed my 26 years, even the two tours on ADAC. They were special to me because, and I guess the biggest part of all of my tours, the people I met I met a lot of really super people, and I'm still in touch with quite a few of them. And they were real friends. I mean, it wasn't just somebody in passing. These were people that you'll never forget if you lived to be 100. You know, these were if they were your friend, they would do anything for you. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the most memorable thing about it, was just friendship and the camaraderie on a Navy team.
Well, that's great. Well, I know I speak for Don Hill when I say, you know, we thank you for your service to your country, to our country, and we appreciate the time that you've taken to share your experiences with us. And this now concludes the interview with Larry Edward Kaysen.